Tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump met at the White House with Kim Jong-chol, whom he described as the second most powerful man in North Korea. Mr. Trump told reporters the summit between him and Kim Jong-un is back on. He says the U.S. will not increase pressure on North Korea while talks are ongoing.
I don't even want to use the term maximum pressure anymore because I don't want to use that term. Because we're getting along, you see the relationship, we're getting along. So it's not a question of maximum pressure, it's staying essentially the way it is.
The president also said sanctions on North Korea will not be lifted until Pyongyang agrees to give up its nuclear arsenal. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis criticized China's militarization of disputed South China Sea islands, insisting that weapon systems recently deployed in the area are meant to intimidate Beijing's neighbors. He spoke at the Shangri-La Defense Dialogue in Singapore, where the Trump-Kim summit will take place June 12th. Mattis noted the presence of U.S. troops in South Korea will not be on the table at the summit, as some have suggested.
Any discussion about the number of U.S. troops in the Republic of Korea is subject to, one, the Republic of Korea's invitation to have them there, and the discussions between the United States and the Republic of Korea, separate and distinct from the negotiations that are going on with DPRK.
Again, U.S. Defense Chief Jim Mattis. The United States is escalating transatlantic and North American trade tensions, imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from the EU, Canada, and Mexico. President Trump says the U.S. will no longer be taken advantage of in trade deals. More at VOANews.com. This is VOA News. The United States has vetoed a U.N. Security Council draft resolution seeking protection for Palestinian civilians, while a U.S. drafted text that blamed the Palestinian militant group Hamas for the recent surge in violence also failed. Nikki Haley is a U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
The United States drafted a Security Council statement that would have condemned Hamas for launching rockets and endangering civilians. This should have been a no-brainer. You would think no one would want to side with Hamas when it comes to condemning rocket launches. But the statement was blocked.
And this is the second time the Trump administration has used its veto to block a measure in the council it sees as anti-Israeli. The first was in December when the U.S. was isolated 14-1 in a vote calling for the withdrawal of the Trump administration's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Officials in Venezuela say that they have freed 39 political activists who were jailed for their involvement in protests against the government. Human rights groups say the government of President Nicolas Maduro has detained hundreds of people for participating in widespread demonstrations against his government. Maduro won a second six-year term on May 20th in a much-criticized presidential election. Venezuela's leading opposition parties boycotted the vote, and two of their most popular leaders were barred from running in the election. A socialist takes over as Spain's prime minister after outgoing leader Mariano Rajoy lost a parliamentary confidence vote.
Jessica Barry is just that.
And a senior official from the International Committee of the Red Cross warns that hate speech promoted on social media in war-torn Central African Republic is inflaming divisions between the Muslim and Christian communities.
In the never-ending cycle of poverty and violence, she says no place in the country is secure. She says outbreaks of fighting in urban areas, such as the capital Bangui and in Bambari, CAR's commercial center, has forced whole communities to flee and has triggered unrest in other areas.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting for VOA. Populists have taken over power in Italy for the first time with the swearing-in of a new government pulling together in a coalition. It's a political movement that is anti-migrant and Eurosceptic. The political novice Giuseppe Conte is the new premier. He and his 18 cabinet ministers pledged their loyalty to the Italian Republic and to the nation's post-war constitution. This all occurred in front of the president, Sergio Mattarella. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening. It's Saturday, June 2nd. Welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Clote has the day off.
Mali's own soldiers are taking part in the fight against regional instability, but they are in great need of better equipment and better pay. Until they receive those things, Mali will depend heavily on foreign forces to protect its borders and its people.
The United Nations marks 70 years of the world body's peacekeeping operations.
The capacity to be able to address any outbreak is now improved in the affected countries as well as in other places.
The World Health Organization is all a vaccination campaign in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
I see there's a lot of fighting because when we go to the water, we queue. The water starts from 7:30. By 8 o'clock, they close the tank.
And we take a look at how Cape Town in South Africa is coping with the water crisis. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres marked the 70th birthday of the world body's peacekeeping operations this week by paying a visit to Mali. The West African nation hosts a UN mission known as MINUSMA. Guterres reinforced his commitment to the mission, which is the deadliest ongoing mission for UN peacekeeping forces, but also asked for more support to keep it strong. For VOA, Bram Post-Mohamas reports from Bamako.
The United Nations family in Mali came out in force this week to mark what it called Blue Helmet Day, a day to honour the servicemen and women who put themselves in harm's way for peace. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was on hand to take part in the ceremonies. The UN mission in Mali has cost the lives of almost 100 military personnel and 172 people in all. It is the highest death toll of any ongoing UN peacekeeping mission in the world. There are 13,500 peacekeepers in Mali, and that's not all. The French have their Operation Barkhane, and the European Union trains Malian army personnel. And there's another peace mission on the horizon, G5, a force with soldiers from Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, Chad and Mauritania. Guterres went to see the G5 headquarters in central Mali on Wednesday.
Il y a énormément d'obstacles auxquels le Mali fait face. Il y a d'un côté cette convergence.
Speaking at the end of his visit, the UN Secretary General asked for more and predictable international financial support for the G5. The G5, he told reporters, is tasked with fighting terrorist movements and organized crime in the Sahel region and help protect the civilian population. But its financial situation is insecure. Mali's own soldiers are taking part in the fight against regional instability, but they are in great need of better equipment and better pay. Until they receive those things, Mali will depend heavily on foreign forces to protect its borders and its people. Guterres announced that those foreign forces, and especially the UN's mission to Mali, are working on measures to increase their own protection. The spectacular attack last April that severely damaged Timbuktu Airport, where MINUSMA has a base, was a stark reminder of how vulnerable these troops can be.
En même temps, c'est évident qu'il nous faut perfectionner la façon dont
the UN will install closed-circuit surveillance systems at the main base in Bamako, advanced warning systems and radar at some camps in the north. It will use sniffer dogs to find explosives, do extensive situational awareness training, and conduct more operations designed to secure terrain. Will this be enough? A lot depends on the amount of international support that will be available for Mali, MINUSMA, and the regional G5 Sahel force. Currently, there are serious shortfalls, and this poses future problems. As Guterres put it, a failed Mali is a danger not only for its neighbours, but for a region stretching from the Sahel, across the Mediterranean, and deep into Europe. He said that containing the terrorist problem is better than dealing with its effects. Bram Postumus for VOA News, Bamako.
A senior official from the International Committee of the Red Cross warns that hate speech promoted on social media in war-torn Central African Republic is inflaming divisions between the Muslim and Christian communities. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
Jessica Barry is just back from a six-month stint as ICRC coordinator in Central African Republic. She says the humanitarian situation there is at a critical low, and the international community must pay attention to the desperation of the people caught in the never-ending cycle of poverty and violence. She says no place in the country is secure. She says outbreaks of fighting in urban areas, such as the capital Bangui and in Bambari, CAR's commercial center, has forced whole communities to flee and has triggered unrest in other areas.
Despite the huge efforts to keep communities together, the efforts of all the religious leaders to talk amongst themselves, to try and talk with the different communities, when I see that this is not working and when I see that there is hate speech arriving and being promoted on social media, the whole country is fragile and we have to ring the alarm bells.
Barry tells VOA Muslim and Christian communities in Bambari want to live together, but are being driven apart by violence and revenge attacks that trigger other assaults. She says it is much harder to persuade people to live side by side again than to keep them separated.
There are so many different factors that just then make people frustrated and people join together. And then, yes, the provocations on social media are certainly, I would say, a factor. Of course, the network is not so extensive in Central African Republic. It's the main towns and Bangui. But then rumors spread and people talk.
The Red Cross official says efforts to achieve peace in the Central African Republic are made more difficult by the extreme poverty, poor health conditions, and low education levels in the country. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Health Organization has expanded its Ebola vaccination campaign in the Democratic Republic of Congo to include high-risk people in three areas. Latest figures show 37 confirmed cases and 13 probable ones. Lisa Schlein once again reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Since the start of the Ebola vaccination campaign in May, the World Health Organization says 682 people have been vaccinated. Among them, nearly 500 in Imbandaka, a city of more than 1 million people. The campaign recently was expanded to include Bikoro, where Ebola was first discovered on May 8th, and the Iboko Health Zone, which is the most remote of the three areas. Those immunized include health workers, responders, and other people at high risk of falling ill from the fatal disease. WHO officials say the vaccine, which has not been formally approved, appears to be providing protection and giving rise to hope that it can help stop the spread of the Ebola virus. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who was president of Liberia during the unprecedented Ebola epidemic in West Africa, shares that hope. Ebola broke out in West Africa in late 2013. By the time it was brought under control in 2016, the disease had killed more than 11,000 people in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. Liberia lost 4,800 people during that outbreak. While on a visit to Geneva earlier this week, she told VOA there has been an improvement in healthcare delivery systems, including infection control, since the experience with Ebola.
And so the capacity to be able to address any outbreak is now improved. in the affected countries as well as in other places. I think there's an important new dimension in the fight for Ebola, and that is vaccines.
Sirleaf says vaccine trials in Guinea and now in the DRC have shown good results.
We're hoping that DRC, like others, will have a capacity to deal with it, to stop the spread. We're hoping that DRC will come out of this, you know, without the major effect, the major results that we saw in the three countries that were not prepared for this.
The vaccine developer Merck has contributed 7,500 doses of the Ebola vaccine to the DRC. The company says as many as 300,000 more doses are available in case of a serious outbreak. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Over 200 local and international companies have been participating in the International Trade Fair, which started nearly 2 weeks ago in Malawi's commercial capital, Blantyre. Malawi President Peter Mutharika opened the two-week-long trade exhibition. It has drawn participants from India, Thailand, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Mozambique, and Ghana. For VOA, Lameka Masina reports from Blantyre.
Traditional dances were among the activities that marked the opening of International Trade Fair in Malawi's commercial capital, Blantyre. The event, which has attracted 262 local and foreign exhibitors, seeks to provide an opportunity for traders to showcase their goods and services. It will also allow international participants to interact with Malawian businesses and negotiate business deals. Malawi President Peter Mutharika officially opened the event.
These are times to showcase the pride of our industry. I've toured around the exhibitions. I'm extremely impressed with what we Malawians are capable of doing. What I've seen today says one thing. From our small efforts, we can do great things for our country. I've seen that in our unity. We can do great wonders for Malawi and for Africa.
Mutharika toured the fair, including the pavilions of companies that produce seed, sugar, and confectionaries. He says this year's theme, which focuses on moving beyond agriculture and simply exporting raw materials, is relevant to the needs of Africa today.
This is timely because industrialization must be the next step for Africa. African countries cannot progress and break out of a cycle of poverty if we do not industrialize. Investing in industrialization is one of the best ways of supporting the private sector.
He says Malawi has already started taking steps to achieve this by creating an economic environment that ensures the growth of local industries and enterprises. The Reserve Bank of Malawi recently reduced the rate at which commercial banks borrow from the central bank from 18% to 16%. The Reserve Bank says this was in response to the stable economy. In response, some commercial banks have reduced their interest rates by 2%.
We have reduced interest rates to make business access capital from banks more easily. We have taken our forex reserves to the highest levels to enable business to trade internationally with ease.
Prince Kapondangaga is the president of the Malawi Confederation of Chambers of Commerce and Industry. He says the country faces challenges to industrialization, like persistent power outages. Malawi has the capacity to generate 300 megawatts, but the country is struggling today even to reach half of that amount. As a result, consumers face 4 to 8 hours of power rationing every day.
Use of alternative sources of energy such as diesel-powered generators have proven to be costly to an extent that companies are now diverting a sizable amount of their budget to finance generator sets and diesel while upholding recruitment and salary increments plans at bay, hence reducing the employment rates even further down.
Kabunda Ngaga is therefore asking the government to provide a conducive business environment for independent power producers who could easily alleviate the power outages. President Mutharika says his administration, has long-lasting solutions to boost power production, including plans to install wind, solar and hydropower equipment in strategic sites throughout the country. In the meantime, the sole power supplier, the Electricity Supply Corporation of Malawi, has suspended power rationing at the site of exhibition until the close of the trade fair. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Muslims around the world are fasting to mark Ramadan. Some Nigerian Muslims say the holy month has become too expensive with price increases on food in some markets. From Abuja, Nigeria, for VOA, Gift Agiriga takes a look at the reasons behind the price rise.
In a recent survey, traders blame the problem on high demand for the commodities which are not in season and on the hoarding of some foods to maximize profits. In the popular Wuse market in Abuja, Ismaila Abdullahi sells Irish potatoes and tomatoes. He says sellers get their supplies from Jos in Plateau State. He says if you look, you will notice they are not in season and are also not freshly harvested. He says during Ramadan, traders sell Irish potatoes because of the demand. A basket which used to sell for about $2 now sells for $4. Also, a large raffia basket holding over 2,000 tomatoes, which used to sell for about $19, now sells for nearly $42. It has been driven up by the rainy season, which affects the yield. For example, he says, the tomatoes he is showing me come from the Niger Republic because in Nigeria they are scarce and expensive at the moment. Malam Usman Mohammed says the prices have also increased for fruits which are highly consumed during Ramadan. Before the holy month, watermelon was sold for between $1. Now, a watermelon costs about $2, while a pineapple, which usually costs $1, is now sold for $2. Popular grains like millet, beans, wheat, and rice are also becoming more expensive. Malam Kabir Khalid, who is a grain dealer, blames the price rise on inflation, whereby people increase prices because the cost of imported items has increased. He says a bag of millet now sells for $15 and $16. A bag of local rice sells for $33 and $36, while a bag of sorghum sells for $39 and $41. Consumers' complaints come despite continuous admonitions by Islamic scholars for traders to make things easier for the people to gain the blessings of the holy month. Meanwhile, economists say a significant decrease in the cost of fertilizers will make things easy for the farmers and perhaps reduce the price of foodstuff. They, however, say that the government should look into the artificial price hikes to determine the causes of market fluctuations only, like low supply and high demand, and which are inflated by greed. Some consumers are cynical. They say there's always a reason given to raise prices, including crop diseases, bad roots, and increase in fuel price. They are not expecting prices to drop, at least not over next month. For VOA, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja.
In Cape Town, some enterprises who depend on water to make money are struggling to stay in business as the city endures one of the most serious droughts ever in South Africa. Some factories have drilled their own boreholes, while other companies have invested heavily in systems that recycle water. For VOA, Darren Taylor takes a look at how two businesses from different sides of Cape Town's social spectrum are surviving the water crisis.
It's a sight you don't expect to see in a place where the city administration has asked residents to use no more than 50 litres of water each a day. Children careening down gushing slides into pools of fresh water. This is Water World, a fun park based entirely around water, of course. Its manager, Markham Adams, says he and the owners never anticipated intense water shortages in Cape Town, which once boasted some of the highest rainfall figures in South Africa. But 12 years ago, they found a water source beneath their feet, as Adam says.
All of our water we use in the slides is all well point water. It's off the municipal grid. It's been off for the last 8-9 years. You've got the Lawrence River just adjacent to us here running into the sea, and I think it's probably a lot of that underground water from the Lawrence River that we're picking up.
A pump extracts water from one of the two wells that keep Water World open.
We did write to the municipality and said to them, listen, we understand the pressure on fresh water and drinking water. If we don't use the water, it just flows further down into the sea anyway. So just understand the logic that there's no other person that can use the water that needs it for farming or whatever else. So they said, look, the logic makes sense, so we'll leave you for now.
But as Adams explains, some other venues that rely on water haven't been as fortunate as Water World.
All of your parks that run on municipal water, they've all been closed. Your municipal swimming pools, they've all been closed.
He says people who think that the park's wasting water often confront him.
Some friendly question, some kind of irate and like, hang on, what's going on here? We don't have water to wash, what are you doing? So we have to explain to them what water it is that we're using.
Adam says now that the drought's really biting, mothers and their children often arrive at Water World in the early evening.
They pop in here at about 5:30. They're in here for 15 minutes and the mums jokingly say they've had their bath for the night, so they don't have to use.
The business has a regular supply of fresh water, but still saves as much as possible.
Wherever you look, you see we're catching all of the water. When it comes out of the slides, you can see it's being collected. There's drains collecting water wherever it runs back into a reservoir.
From there, the water is reused. Far away from the middle-class haven of Water World, in Cape Town's Khayelitsha Township, 26-year-old Philip Tutsi and his car washer colleagues also depend on water for work.
When the rain is raining, we fetch water and we wash car. Even taxis, that water, we fetch it by the drain like this.
These days, it hardly rains. But Tutsi says the sewers of the overpopulated shack land are always bursting with wastewater.
That water, it flows every day, doesn't stop. We go there, we take the buckets and we pour, we take water after we go and wash their cars.
So this is the water now that's flowing in the drains of the city where you and other people come and collect water.
Yeah, yes, chief. To wash car and do many things, even clothes we can wash it.
Okay.
But not to cook because this is dirty.
Tutsi squeezes dishwashing liquid into a bucket of drain water and uses it to clean a taxi. He says he used to collect water at a communal water point but doesn't anymore because since the drought, there's too much violence there.
I see there's a lot of fighting because when we go to the water, we queue. The water starts from 7:30. By 8 o'clock, they close the tank.
This, Tutsi says, means many people are left without water, and sometimes they fight one another for it.
Like, I can take a stone and hit you, or I can do the wrong thing to you, because also me, I need water. But if I doesn't care water, my child and my family doesn't go to eat and wash and survive without water.
South Africans like Tutsi have always suffered to access water during times of water plenty and scarcity. Still, says the young man, life is good because he's working and he doesn't need his own tap to make his way through life. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Cape Town.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And see you to come. We still have the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from the continent. Yes, it's now time for a Saturday Music Spot. Time to relax and enjoy great African music. Here we go.
Some Pendo kwa bidi, misi na budi kuhifadhi pendo moyoni wakukava na fasi nani cause all you need I know me every day minasari tusirudi nyuma oh no 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 mana macho menifungua matafora mateso kuvunjania wendo moponya moyo wangu uliovunjwa na kukimbiwa so hadithi kusimuliwa amani za kale kweli wendo umeponya jera. Kwenye maisha yangu nitakulinda kama mboni, nitakulinda kama jicho langu.
Try again. I got the feeling that I'm jumping again.
I'll make you work it out. Hey, leave it up on me.
Make me love, make me feel it, love me, make me love again. When I do want to know, but I'm a heartbreak. My face on a shot, when I go back, we'll repeat again. What do you think about me? I'm a man, 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 I'm a man,
I'm a
Yeah.
my baby.
I'm a slave in love. I'm a slave in love. Whoa.
situations come and go. Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Another day, another goal. Another day to be a mighty warrior.
Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil.
Yes, that was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Said Hamdun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaites, we thank you for joining us. See you tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On May 8th, health officials in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, reported two confirmed cases of Ebola in the country's northwest. It is the DRC's ninth outbreak of the disease since the discovery of the virus near the country's Ebola River, and the second since the largest ever Ebola epidemic swept across West Africa from 2014 to 2015. Ebola is a viral hemorrhagic fever with average mortality rates ranging from 25 to 90%, depending on the specific strain. According to the World Health Organization, by the end of December 2015, the epidemic that devastated West Africa sickened 28,616 people and killed 11,310 across 10 countries. Ebola is a disease of the thick forest, where people and wild animals exist in close proximity. Here, people are more likely to eat bushmeat or wild-caught game that may be infected with the disease. That is one of the reasons why Ebola is endemic in the DRC, meaning it is always present there at some level. Since the earliest cases of this outbreak were reported in the DRC's forested region of Bikoro, they have spread to Mbandaka, a major port city. There is now a possibility that the infection could travel down the Congo River to more densely populated areas, such as Kinshasa, the capital, with its population of 10 million. On May 22nd, U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Alex Azar announced that the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, will contribute up to $7 million at this stage to combat the Ebola outbreak in the DRC. This is in addition to the $1 million USAID committed a few days earlier to help prevent the spread of this deadly disease. The United States is also sending a team of public health experts to join the efforts of the Ministry of Health of the DRC, the World Health Organization, and other partners. At the same time, we call on the global community to make funding available immediately to support the government of the DRC and the World Health Organization's Health Emergencies Fund, the Contingency Fund for Emergencies, in order to contain the outbreak as soon as possible before it spreads further and harms more people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.